Good afternoon. We're here with another episode of the Sean Moe Hoops podcast, getting ready for the Final Four and the final weekend of college basketball. Pleased to have with me Scott Phillips of NBC Sports and NBC Sports Chicago. Scott appeared earlier in the year, but is one of the most knowledgeable college and high school hoops writers there is. So excited to have Scott come on and talk about the Final Four. Scott, how are you doing today?
Doing well. That's quite the intro that I have to live up to there.
Just trying to set the stage high for the listeners, but I got a lot of pressure
now.
Well, you lived up to it last time when you you went through your, I think it was your top five Chicago players that you had seen, and you came up with a really good list for that. So I think it won't be too difficult.
Fun.
You know, one thing I wanted to just jump right in with, we had the Final Four kicking off on Saturday with Loyola Chicago playing Michigan, two Midwest teams, one team that a lot of people, not myself, but a lot of people thought would make it to the Final Four versus Loyola Chicago, kind of the 11 seed, the Cinderella story. And then we have on the other side, more on the, I'd say, the powerhouse side of a Villanova versus Kansas, so 2-1 seeds. But really want to kick it off and go into Loyola Chicago. They were a team that, you know, I think a lot of people liked, but nobody saw going to the Final Four. And you being in Chicago, I was just curious, you know, what is the mood in Chicago right now about the situation, and how's everybody feeling about Loyola?
I think everyone's really embracing it, Sean, because you have a city in Chicago right now where the Blackhawks and the Bulls are both going to miss the playoffs for the first time in a decade. Spring training is just ending and the season is getting started for the Cubs and Sox. And of course, the White Sox are in a rebuild themselves, so they're not really expected to compete. So there's not a lot of really great things to glom onto right now in the Chicago sports scene. And for this Loyola run to kind of come out of nowhere, it's been fun for the city. And I'll put it this way, the Gentile Arena where Loyola plays didn't really start selling out until February, so it's not like this was really an early movement in Chicago either. This has been a slow-rolling thing that's slowly gotten steam, and now we're to the point where we're seeing a lot of sellouts and a lot of Loyola gear start to pop up around town.
Yeah, I would imagine that the gear is starting to pop up, and in Chicago you have DePaul and you have Northwestern just outside of the city, and neither one of those schools, even though they've played in the Big East and the Big Ten and are kind of in the power conferences, neither one of them has really experienced much regular season success or tournament success. So does it kind of, you know, what's the dynamic with three schools in Chicago and the two big ones having to play second fiddle to the smaller Loyola Chicago?
It'll be interesting for the future, for sure. Northwestern obviously gained a foothold last year by making its first NCAA tournament, but let's be honest, with Northwestern and Chicago, it's never really been a great relationship in terms of this casual Chicago sports fan embracing Northwestern. It's been a lot of students, a lot of Northside suburban people, but the city itself has never really been that fixated on Northwestern or the successes that they've had in football or basketball. So this Loyola thing's a little bit different because the campus actually is located in Rogers Park. There is a campus as well in the River North neighborhood that is right off of State Street, right off of Michigan Avenue. So it's very accessible for the common casual person who's, you know, a tourist in Chicago who wants to go into that bookstore during the week. So it's been interesting. I think that if DePaul had a resurgence, it would be different because they're more centrally located. If UIC had a run where they maybe made a Loyola type rise, I think that people in the city would embrace them as well. Chicago State certainly as well, but they're on the lower rungs of D1 right now. But yeah, it's kind of a weird dynamic and a weird time in Chicago sports, and Loyola just seems to have found the perfect time to make this run to really capture the imagination. The social media following is something to look at. I think DePaul basketball has like around 3,900 followers, and now Loyola basketball is hovering around 20,000. I mean, wow. To have a Valley program dwarf a Big East program in social media following by about 5 to 6 times the numbers is startling, especially in a major city like Chicago. And I think it speaks as much to DePaul being inept as it does to Loyola capturing this moment.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point. Something I hadn't really thought of in terms of the social media and the actual following. And I'm sure Sister Jean has helped with that as she's kind of become a great national story. But, you know, one thing I wanted to talk to you about, since you're very involved in the high school scene, especially at the Chicago level, and was more of just how did Porter Moser and how did Loyola build this team? You know, for me, for example, I knew they had Milton Doyle last year, who is doing very well in the G League, and I think he might have a two-way contract. And I know he was a play, you know, coming from Chicago and the city, but they weren't a team that was on my radar. And then really in the preseason, I was more looking up Andre Jackson, because he kind of popped up on this list I was looking at in terms of being really efficient, but I didn't know anything about him. So started trying to research him, and I go to their team, and all of a sudden I see, you know, Dante Ingram from Simeon that we both watched, and then Clayton Custer and Ben Richardson. I got to see them. Man, this is going back to like 2013 at the Minnesota Timberwolves shootout, when I went to go watch Rashad Vaughn and Tyus Jones, and I remember those two guys playing on a team. And then you have, you know, Lucas Williamson from Whitney Young, and then Cameron Krutwig, who I wasn't familiar with, but he has been kind of a freshman sensation. So I was just curious, you know, being in Chicago and seeing how they built the team, your thoughts on how this perfect storm happened.
I think Porter Moser and his staff deserve a ton of credit, not only for the in-state local recruiting, as you mentioned, Sean, but for the ways that they've plucked guys from unique levels of basketball to fill out this roster. You know, you touched on the local part, but this roster also features an international guy, a JUCO transfer in Dre Jackson, an up transfer in Clayton Custer, who's going down from the Big 12 to the Valley, an up transfer in Marcus Towns, who's going up from Fairleigh Dickinson to the Valley. So they really got guys from all over the place to find really this perfect 7 or 8 man rotation that just fits so well together. And that's really the special thing about this group. It's that they have 5 unselfish guys on the floor, no matter who's on the floor. And they really pick apart, you know, your defense or your offense, whatever it is, in different ways. They've got a small ball lineup where Dre Jackson can be the center and Dante Ingram's at the 4. They can go bigger with Krutwig at the 5. They've just got so many selfless guys that move the ball very well, that do things on the defensive end that are seamless. And there's some crazy stats about this team in terms of assist rate and 3-point percentage. And they also haven't had a single player foul out once this season, which I think is a really startling statistic. This team doesn't foul. They don't get in foul trouble. They don't ever have to bail themselves out with ridiculous situations. They're almost always in control of the situation, and they play at a very methodical Virginia-like tempo.
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm looking at KenPom right now, and he likes to highlight, you know, if a stat is good, it's green. If it's bad, it's red. And this page is just littered with light green and dark green numbers from their 3-point shooting 40%, to their 2-point shooting 57%, both top 12 in the country. I was curious, because I didn't really know this name that much, but you mentioned Cameron Krutwig, who's the big freshman center. And, you know, what was his reputation in the Chicago area in high school? And did Loyola kind of steal him from some of the bigger programs, or was he just kind of a perfect fit for them and was maybe overlooked by some schools?
I think he was a perfect fit for the Valley, Sean. For me, it's going to be a skewered situation, because I come from the rival high school that Cameron Krutwig played at. He played at Jacobs. I went to Crystal Lake South, right down Randall Road, that are conference rivals. I watched Cameron's brother Conrad play in high school, who was also a Division I player at South Dakota for a little while. He was a little bit undersized at 6'6", but I've known the Krutwig family for over a decade, so it's a little bit different for me in terms of the perception that I maybe had about Cameron, just because I knew it from all along. And you know, he was a special player because of his size, more so than anything. His brother, as I mentioned, was an undersized 6'6" forward. He was a little bit bouncier than Cam, but just didn't have the massive size that you have on the interior that you get with a 6'9", 260s, 270-pound center like Cam. And his passing ability is really what separates him from me. He just really rifles the ball cross-court to find shooters. He doesn't really get fazed by double teams. He can throw bounce passes from the elbows to cutters. He has all sorts of different ways to get the offense moving with the ball in his hands, and that's what makes him such a unique weapon for this Loyola team. I talked about the assist rates and the ball movement. That also comes from the center spot, whether it's Cameron Krutwig or a guy like Dre Jackson playing small ball. All the guys on the floor for this team really move the ball, and they know what they're doing. So to add a passer like that to the mix is a perfect storm. But, you know, he was a perfect fit for the Valley, Sean, because he wasn't necessarily the athlete that high major schools are looking for. And you can kind of see that with how he plays. He's got kind of a unique running style. He still has to lose a little bit of weight and get an ideal shape. And he dropped 30 pounds from his high school days just to play this season. So maybe not the mobility you want to see, especially laterally on the perimeter where you can get him into trouble with some ball screen scenarios. But he's really a talented player who's a perfect fit in the Missouri Valley Conference.
Okay. Well, you know, one thing I'm kind of curious about, because in the Missouri Valley, it's been dominated by Wichita State over the past few years, and they left the conference and went to the American. But last year, Wichita State went 17-1 in the conference, and Illinois State went 17-1, and only one team got in. And so this is, you know, kind of a hypothetical, but I'm kind of curious, you know, if Wichita State had still been in the conference, if the Missouri Valley could have potentially got two teams in, because, you know, we saw a few weeks ago with the tournament, a lot of the teams that were selected were your Syracuses or your Arizona States, these larger schools that maybe had a few more power victories, but in the overall scheme of things, were probably not kind of the better team than maybe a Middle Tennessee State or some other team. So I think it's kind of interesting to wonder, what if Wichita State had still been in the Missouri Valley, and, you know, would this run still have occurred, or would Loyola have kind of toppled Wichita State as the top team in the league?
Interesting point, Sean. I think that Wichita still would have been the favorite and likely the winner in the Valley, just because they have figured out that league so well. They have a depth of 10 guys on this roster that was very, very challenging to compete with at all levels of basketball, let alone the Valley. So I still would have pegged them as the conference favorites, despite their early exit and the success we've seen from Loyola. But those additional 2 to 3 games that those two teams would have played would have certainly boosted Loyola's computer numbers quite a bit. And it's hard to say whether that would have been good enough to get them in as an at-large if they didn't win the conference tournament over Wichita State, but it certainly would have put Loyola more in the conversation. I mean, to have them as an 11 seed and not a 12 seed certainly indicates they were pretty strongly in the field as a mid-major double-digit seed, but they probably had work to do if they needed to get in as an at-large team.
So Loyola Chicago, they play in the first game, and right now they are about a 5 to 5.5 point underdog to Michigan. You know, regarding Michigan, you know, how far did you have them going? And I ask this because when I did a podcast 2 weeks ago, my counterpart had Michigan going to the Final Four, and I laughed at that choice. One, because everybody on ESPN was making it, and two, I really didn't think Michigan was that good of a team. But here they are in the Final Four, and you know, they didn't really have to beat anybody higher than a 4 seed, but that's how the NCAA tournament works. So I was just curious about your thoughts on Michigan and kind of their run that they've made, not only through the tournament, but the Big Ten tournament as well.
I've been pretty surprised by the run that Michigan's made in the tournament. It's because their offense really hasn't showed up besides for the Texas A&M win. And they've really relied on defense. That's been really the key storyline for this whole run for the Wolverines. It's been shocking for me. I had them going out in the second round. I liked what this team is capable of doing. The Final Four hype didn't surprise me, and I thought it was justified. But I really didn't like the makeup of this team, and I didn't like their second round matchups either against Houston or San Diego State, whoever advanced in that game. But they proved me wrong by winning that crazy buzzer beater with Jordan Poole, and they've certainly proven themselves since, especially on the defensive end. And that's really the storyline for this Michigan team, the fact that so many D-line teams of the past were offensive-minded teams that had to throw in a 1-3-1 or a different kind of defense to get stops. This team really comes at you on the defensive end, and Xavier Simpson's a really good, strong perimeter defender to start the top there. And they've got different pieces who have improved and evolved over time. And Charles Matthews coming in from Kentucky also helped that defensive DNA quite a bit. And this is just a very different Michigan team than we've seen in the past from John Beilein. And I think it's a fascinating matchup with Loyola because these are both slow tempo teams who have a lot of similarities. And I think Loyola could easily stick with them if things go the right way and Michigan's not hitting shots like they have 3 out of 4 games in this tournament.
Yeah, definitely. If they're not playing like they did against Texas A&M, I think they could be in for an upset. But you mentioned Charles Matthews, so another Chicago guy, and he kind of had an interesting path of being really highly ranked as, I'd say, a freshman and sophomore, and then kind of fell down the ladder, I'd say, his junior and senior year. Still went to Kentucky, but wasn't really as pronounced as some of the other guys. And he lasted kind of one unsuccessful season before transferring. But he's been a guy really that has impressed me. Just, you know, it looks like he's gotten stronger and really just kind of started to reach what everybody maybe thought he could be back as a freshman and sophomore in high school. So I was just curious about your thoughts on his development and kind of how you've seen him grow from high school to this point in time.
I think with Charles Matthews, it's all about fit. He's always embraced a part where he was really a member of a team instead of having to be a go-to guy. When Charles Matthews had to have the ball in his hands and had to go get a bucket or make a play, that's when I think he struggled a little bit, because that's really not in his DNA to take over a game. He's more of a guy that wants to make an impact on both ends. He'll spring up as a scorer from time to time, but his jumper and his shooting has been so streaky over time that it's hard to really rely on him as a scorer every single time. So I'm happy to see him with this Michigan team, because he doesn't have to be the go-to guy. He's got plenty of other seniors around him and guys like Mo Wagner and Abdur Rahman, who are also potent scorers. And so he doesn't have to carry that team on an every night basis. So if he's on a team where he has to carry things, I don't think it's a good fit. I still think he would have been useful at Kentucky, especially given that so many of those guys want to take shots and want the ball in their hand. He could have been a really useful role player who was kind of like in that Michael Kidd-Gilchrist role where, you know, he was scrapping and getting points off rebounds and off of slashing and things like that, but didn't really shoot a lot. But yeah, it just, that's the way it worked out. He's obviously found a great fit at Michigan, and I think that he's got a chance to continue to grow and develop. He's just got to improve that jumper. It's always been streaky for him.
Yep. So who do you have coming out of the Michigan Loyola side?
I do have Michigan taking that game in a close one, and I think it's because of their bigs. Mo Wagner and Duncan Robinson have floor spacing capability that Loyola really hasn't faced during this tournament yet. The Ramblers have faced some good big guys, guys like DeJuan Hewell at Miami and Grant Williams at Tennessee, and you know, they've faced some guys down low that they can hang with, but they haven't had a big who could really take them and stretch out the floor quite yet. And again, that's a little bit of an issue with a guy like Cam Crutwig, who's not quite lateral, so you could put him in ball screen scenarios and pick and pops. And for that small ball lineup that Loyola likes to throw out there, a guy like Mo Wagner can shoot over the top of that because he's got a 4-inch height advantage on Dre Jackson. So I think if Mo Wagner and Duncan Robinson start getting unlocked and hitting perimeter shots, then Loyola could be in trouble, and that could be the difference.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a good point you brought up in terms of the potential mismatches that Michigan brings. But I think it should be, you know, should be a good game, and definitely kind of a good lead in to, I'd say, really the main matchup of Villanova and Kansas, two 1 seeds. I think everybody expected Villanova to get back to the Final Four after getting upset early last year. And I think some people definitely had Kansas, and a lot of people could see Kansas making it, but with the bracket they're in, Kansas, Duke, Michigan State, I think it was kind of a toss-up. But Kansas won in overtime against Duke on Sunday, and I'd say one of the better tournament games so far. And now, right now, Kansas is a 5-point underdog to Villanova, but there's a lot of similarities between the two teams. And, you know, when looking at this matchup, what are some of the either the mismatches or what are some of the areas that you're looking at in terms of determining who's going to come out on top?
I'm really looking at the battle of bigs between Villanova's Omari Spellman and Kansas center Udoka Azubuike as one of the keys for this one. Azubuike has been a storyline throughout this tournament because of his knee injury and the limited minutes that he's been able to play throughout this tournament. And he really only played, I think, 19 or 20 minutes in that win over Duke, and Jayhawks were still able to prevail. That really is a testament to where this team is at right now and how far they've come, because I don't think a couple months ago they would have beaten a team like Duke without Azubuike in the lineup. But you know, Silvio De Sousa stepped up his play, but I think Omari Spellman, kind of similar to the Michigan Loyola angle, brings a floor spacing element at the five that really hasn't been seen very much by Kansas in this tournament. You know, Marvin Bagley popped out and hit that three-pointer, but he only had 9 shots in 44 minutes. And it's not like the three-pointer is an integral part of his offense. With Omari Spellman, he's regularly taking three-pointers. He's taken 140 of them this season. That's a regular part of his game where he's stepping out and spacing the floor. And again, with Azubuike coming off of that knee injury, not being the most mobile big man to begin with, I'm wondering how Kansas is able to hang with a Villanova team if they start hitting shots at all five spots on the floor.
Yeah, I mean, Villanova, they can put points up in a hurry, and it's crazy to look at their numbers with Jalen Brunson shooting over 40%, Mikal Bridges over 40%, Dante DiVincenzo just under 40%, and then you have Omari Spellman, a 6'8 center that's shooting almost 45%. So, you know, in terms of their shooting and outside prowess, it's definitely impressive. You know, talking about Kansas for a second, Malik Newman, he's been kind of one of the key cogs to get them to the Final Four. And, you know, we both got to watch him in AU a lot because he was playing on the 17-9. He was scoring, you know, 20 plus points a game, even as a young kid. So he's always had that ability to score. And I say kind of fell off the map going to Mississippi State and then redshirting a year. But, you know, how has Malik kind of appeared to you? And what are some of your thoughts on his performance so far?
I think he's just feeling it from three-point range lately, and it's been really the whole month of March, not just the NCAA tournament. I mean, he's had 4 more three-pointers, I believe, in 7 or 6 of his last 7 games, which really means that he's confident from that range. And that was really the biggest part of his game as a high school player. I don't know if you'd agree with me on this, Sean, but kind of that ability to shoot pull-up threes and to hit so many threes in a flurry where you had to defend him off the line, and that's when he got going off the bounce. And it seemed like this season he tried to show that he could attack off the dribble before making shots, and sometimes that didn't really work out well for him. But now that he's got the threat of that perimeter jumper back, it really shakes a lot of teams up. And that performance he put on, especially in overtime against Duke, was really, really a memorable game. And just an unbelievable shooting performance from Malik Newman. If he's shooting like that, that puts kind of Kansas's offense at another level that we haven't seen from them so far this season.
Yeah, it definitely gives them, as you said, another level. And when you're talking, I was just remembering back to one of the Nike EYBL events, and I think it was in the spring of 2013. And I don't even think we knew each other at the time, but Malik was playing in Dallas going against I'm forgetting who it was. It was Spice Indy. And I think he had over 40 points in that game, but how he scored it, he was basically coming down and attacking off the pick and roll, but he was also coming down and just shooting off the bounce, off the pick and roll from the 3-point line or pulling up in a defender's face and really kind of getting that little extra burst, to get up into the air. Cause I feel when he's kind of a spot up shooter, he doesn't really get that burst, and he falls short on a lot of his attempts. But yeah, I think that's a big part of his game is getting those kind of pull up threes, and he's definitely been able to exploit that over the past few weeks. So regarding Villanova and Kansas, I think I can tell the way you're leaning, but who do you have coming out of this one?
I do think Villanova wins this one. They do have some issues if they are cold from the perimeter. Their defense has been suspect at times this year, but I think it was really encouraging for Villanova that they won in a game against Texas Tech that wasn't really played at their best and played at their tempo. They won a rock fight against a Red Raiders team that wanted to muck that game up. They got physical on the offensive glass, and that's a really positive sign heading into this Kansas game.
Okay, so you have a Villanova Michigan championship, and Who do you have coming out of that one?
I think Villanova prevails ultimately, Sean. Two titles in 3 years. I think that this team's offensive firepower and the way that they're peaking right now at the right time has really made them an intriguing title team. And again, we talked about the ability to space the floor at all five spots and the mismatches that they've created. And if Villanova's defending at all and they're hitting the glass hard with guys like Spellman and Eric Paschal, then I think this team's the team to beat.
Okay. I can't disagree with that. And I got to watch them, unfortunately, take down UNC 2 years ago in the championship game. But, with Jalen Brunson leading the attack, I feel like this is kind of a Chicago podcast, but Jalen Brunson was another Chicago guy that we both got to watch. And I think we both always thought he would be a great college point guard. Do you see him sticking around for his senior season? Or do you think he, especially if they win the championship, 2 and 3 years, that he's going to go try his hand in the NBA?
I think he would be smart to test the process, as a lot of guys are doing. And, you get that feedback from NBA teams. You get to work out in a few instances. You build a rapport and a relationship with some NBA front office personnel. And I think that's a valuable experience no matter what age in college you are. But Jalen Brunson would also have the unique distinction of potentially playing for a third national title, which would almost be unprecedented, especially at this point in the way that the game is being played. And with most of Villanova set to potentially return next year, again, I would expect Mikal Bridges to also go to the NBA draft. But if a lot of those guys come back, then Villanova has a really intriguing case to be a national title team once again next year. They get Javon Quinterly and McDonald's All-American to come in to help alongside the backcourt. Guys like Dante DiVincenzo and Gillespie have stepped up their play this year. And, this is just a team that's been on a roll these last couple of years. It's a program that's been built to sustain. And even if they lose guys like Brunson and Bridges, they still should be tough next season.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely agree. Especially if, Jalen and Quinterly team up, that would kind of be like a Archie Diacono and Brunson, kind of the reverse of the freshman and the senior. But, they've done a great job in terms of building that program, and Jay Wright, in terms of his recruiting, of just continuously getting, one to two really strong level players that will be around for a few years. So it'll definitely be interesting to see, between the Villanova and Kansas game. And then if those two teams don't beat each other up, if they still have enough in the tank to take on, say, a Michigan or even Loyola. But one thing I wanted to circle back on was, since I haven't chatted with you really about the tournament, not going to go through kind of your overall thoughts, but going back to the first weekend, you have UVA versus UMBC and the first one seed to get upset. And this is a question I was asked just a few days before it happened. But do you think you'll ever see a one seed get upset in your lifetime? And I said no, even though then I had pointed to, look at Wofford beating UNC on UNC's home court as kind of a 24-point underdog. So it's definitely feasible. But I was just kind of curious, going back a few weeks, about your UMBC thoughts taking down UVA.
I was in the same boat as you, Sean. I never thought that we would see a 16-1. And the reason is the tournament is purposely stacked in favor to make sure that the worst teams are facing the number one seeds. It's unfathomable. I mean, I'm still shaking my head at it, weeks later, that not only we saw a 16-1, but it was the number one overall seed in the tournament, and it was a 20-point blowout. And UMBC legitimately ran Virginia off the floor in the second half. And, that's been Virginia's issue in the NCAA tournament over the years, is when a team gets hot and they score in the 70s, they haven't had a way to really counter that and be able to score with elite-level, high-powered offenses. But this was a team in UMBC that just started getting hot from three and ran away from them. And that shows that Tony Bennett's model has some flaws in it in terms of a tournament perspective. And, yeah, the whole thing is just stunning weeks later. I'm sure we'll see a bunch of documentaries about this over time.
Yeah, I was, even though DeAndre Hunter went out, I thought that maybe hurt them from a championship perspective, but definitely didn't see UMBC doing what they did. But, I think for UVA and Tony Bennett, he gets them playing at such a high level in the regular season. And, they come into each game with a very specific intensity and focus that a lot of schools don't normally bring. So I feel like, you know, sometimes they might be seeded and perform better in the regular season than in reality, for example. But that'll be kind of an interesting offseason discussion as a lot of people will, I'm sure, hate on Tony Bennett, but you know, definitely something I didn't see coming. And as you said, I'm sure there'll be a 30 for 30 coming about that team over the next few years. You know, trying basically transitioning from the Final Four and college, tonight we have the McDonald's All-American game going on, which features 24 of the top high school players in the country. And for the past, I don't know, 5 to 6 years, it's been in Chicago. This year it's being held in Atlanta. And I know this is an event that you've been able to attend a lot over the years, and you've seen a lot of these high school players play probably hundreds of times in AAU and high school. And I know you can't really gather a lot from the actual game sometimes. There's not a lot of defense and a lot of, you know, ball hogging, et cetera. But I was just curious, you know, some of the players that you're excited to watch in the game tonight, and then also some of the players that you think, you know, could be leading their teams to the Final Four next season.
I think the major storyline for the McDonald's game and the freshman class as a whole next year is probably going to be Duke. When you look at the star power of that class with RJ Barrett, Zion Williamson, Trey Jones, and Cam Reddish all being in the top 10, and many services having Reddish, Williamson, and Barrett as top three, that's a unique star power that we really haven't seen in quite some time. And there's people already talking about this as potentially the greatest recruiting class of all time in terms of just those four, maybe not the sheer numbers of some of these other seven-man classes we've seen over the years. But I want to see how those Duke guys kind of play together tonight, because I still don't see how they fit together. They all kind of play similar positions and need the ball in their hands. So RJ Barrett and Zion Williamson are together on the East team. Trey Jones and Cam Reddish are together on the West team. Those are some storylines I'm watching with those guys, and they'll be expected to compete for a national title next year as well, although I wouldn't put them in any kind of category to be a favorite given what we don't know about the returning roster quite yet. And for me, I'm also watching out for Kansas. The West team roster has Devin Dotson and Quentin Grimes. Bill Self has run that two-guard system so effectively over these last couple years. He's really embraced having two floor generals on the floor at the same time. Quentin Grimes, a little bit taller and can play off the ball as well. Charlie Moore, a transfer from Cal, will also be in the mix in that backcourt for Kansas. But we're kind of getting a glimpse into the future of the Jayhawk backcourt for next season with the way that these guys are going to play, because guys like Devontae Graham and Svi Mykhailiuk are graduating. They're going to need some new firepower on the perimeter, and guys like Dotson and Grimes are going to step up and play immediate minutes in that rotation next season.
Okay. Well, yeah, in terms of Kansas, I think it's kind of a great 1-2 punch. I'd say I'm really high on Dotson. Didn't get to watch him that much in person, but the first time I saw him was at an Under Armour AU event out in LA. And, you know, I think he got a steal and just took off down the court. And that was all I really needed to see, was just that elite level speed he has. I think he'll definitely be a strong true point guard for Kansas. And then you have Grimes, who I'm not as high on, but I think him being able to operate off the ball will serve him well. If he was going to a school as kind of the primary point guard, I think that would be difficult for him. But I think the combination of the two should be fun to watch. And then, yeah, as you were mentioning, you know, even though Duke lost on Sunday, there's still kind of the talk of the college basketball world with who they have coming in next year, and it'll definitely be interesting to see how the pieces fit. I think it'll be pretty beneficial for either Cam or Barrett to kind of be that typical Duke stretch four that they didn't have this year, but you know, starting with Jabari to Winslow to Ingram and then Tatum last year, of really these wings that can take advantage of their offensive versatility on the offensive end and kind of attack the slower bigs that they might be guarded. And I know Duke didn't have that this year with all the big guys, but I think they'll kind of be able to flourish next year in that role. But how will they do is another question. Is there anybody, I know you kind of mentioned the Duke and Kansas guys, but maybe, you know, one player that isn't as widely hyped as a Zion Williamson or a Cam Reddish that you think could either have an impact next year or maybe will be one of those guys that, you know, goes into the season without a lot of buzz, but then all of a sudden becomes, you know, kind of the NCAA darling or maybe that NBA lottery pick that people didn't expect?
I could see the Vanderbilt crew of Darius Garland and Semi Chatu getting a lot more headlines than they are right now. I feel like those guys are getting slept on a little bit because they are going to not really a traditional basketball powerhouse in Vanderbilt, but I think Semi Chatu is really, really talented, and he's got a chance to really break out as one of these star players in this freshman class next season, and a guy who could be on NBA radars because of his 6'10" size. And he does a lot of things very, very well. And I'm very intrigued to see how his skill level and overall game translates to the college level, especially having legit talent around him. In the UIBL at times, he didn't have a lot of high major talent playing around him. And I want to see how he has the floor spacing and other weapons around him. And Darius Garland's going to be a really effective pull-up shooter from three-point range. He can handle the point. He's a little bit on the smaller side, so maybe not on your pro radar as much, but he could be a very effective college point guard as soon as next season for the Commodores.
Yeah, he can shoot the lights out. We got to see him a lot in the USA events, and he's always been, you know, kind of making it through the first cuts, but not making it to the final team, but he's always shown his ability to shoot with a quick release and a really deep range. So definitely think he'll be a good addition to Vanderbilt and the SEC, especially after their disappointing season this year. You know, one school we didn't touch on, which is usually the team everybody's talking about, but Kentucky. Obviously this year they struggled through a lot of the season and kind of turned the corner in the SEC. But obviously it's kind of a question mark of who returns for that team. But, you know, Emmanuel Quickley and kind of the Kentucky guys impacting the season next year.
Yeah, that's an interesting scenario, Sean, because we have murmurs right now as of this moment of guys like Kevin Knox potentially talking about returning next season. And with, again, multiple McDonald's All-Americans and Emmanuel Quickley and Keldon Johnson and a really good player in Tyler Hero coming in, it means that we could have another potential platoon system emerging for Kentucky because they just have too many guys that need to see minutes. And I think there's not really a ton of bona fide pro prospects on the roster for this Kentucky team, minus guys like Knox and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Diallo. But yeah, it'll be fascinating to see who comes back, who decides maybe to transfer, and who decides to go pro, because there's so many guys on this team like Nick Richards, who wasn't getting minutes at the end of the year. Jared Vanderbilt only played 14 of 34 games. I mean, we could see, again, up to 10 or 11 guys on this roster who were high-end four-star, five-star prospects next year.
Yeah, you know, it'll be interesting to see who leaves. You know, I think Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Diallo and Knox will be gone, but you know, does PJ Washington stick around? I would imagine Quade Green is sticking around, and how does that kind of mesh with the incoming players that they have? You know, right now there's a three undecided players: Romeo Langford, EJ Montgomery, Jordan Brown. I think all players that teams would love to get, and maybe outside of Romeo, you know, I think they're all difference makers, but not potentially swing the outcome. But I was just curious about your thoughts on Romeo and EJ, for example, and where, if you had any predictions on where they might end up.
I haven't really been involved in the recruiting news for those guys, so I'm not going to make any kind of projections. But, you know, Romeo Langford, I'm fascinated to watch in particular because he's a guy who's been in the top five of that class since he was a sophomore. Tapered off a little bit because he maybe didn't bring the intensity or the overall consistency of some of his peers, but he has as much talent as anybody in this class when he has it rolling. And I've seen him go for 40-point games and have it going with the pull-up jumper and doing anything he wanted on the floor as a shooter. So I'm kind of interested to see how he looks in this game tonight with his peers and also where he decides to go to school next year. He could end up going to Vanderbilt with guys like Darius Garland and Semi Chatu, but he's got a lot of other great options as well where he could come in and make an impact right away.
Okay. And then last question on the McDonald's game, but I was just curious about your Darius Bazley thoughts. I know he played with the Chicago AU team Mean Streets, and I think he's been doing pretty well in the practices, and just kind of with his size and length, starting to get a little bit of maybe some love from the NBA guys. But I was just interested in your thoughts on him.
Well, Jim Boeheim will do everything he can to quell that NBA interest. Trust me, he'll downplay Darius Bazley like he played it, downplayed everybody else on his roster. But yeah, I think Darius Bazley's got a ton of potential. He's 6'9". He's got that really long wingspan that you mentioned, Sean, and just a perfect fit on the wing for that 2-3 zone that Syracuse likes to run. And, you know, they maybe didn't have a lot of offensive playmakers this year. Tyus Battle did a lot of things on his own. If he has a guy like Bazley with him and he returns, then Syracuse could have a much better offense next season. This was a team that snuck up on people this year with their Sweet 16 appearance, but with a McDonald's All-American like Bazley and some additional shooting entering the mix, I think they could be an intriguing team in the ACC next year.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And obviously they had their little run at the end, but I think Jim Boeheim is looking forward to, you know, getting back to actually challenging the Dukes and UNCs and UVAs at the top of the conference. So that's definitely a good rundown of the game tonight, and it'll kind of provide a first glimpse for a lot of people into who really are going to be the top players in the country next year from a college or NBA standpoint. But at the same time, as we know, the game is usually very, very loose and filled with a lot of highlights. So not a whole lot that can be, I'd say, fully taken away, but definitely a good first viewing opportunity for some people tonight. Last question for you, and this is switching out of the college high school realm. But I know in the NBA world, Markelle Fultz just kind of had his first return this week, scoring, I think it was 10 points off the bench. And I know you've been kind of a Markelle fan from the early stages, and obviously he's gone through some difficulties, but how do you think he'll do the rest of the season? And do you think he'll kind of be able to regain kind of the skill level and ability that he showcased throughout kind of his later high school stages?
I think he'll be able to recapture what he was doing earlier in his career, Sean. This is a guy who has such a unique skill level and a unique athleticism about him as well, with just the way that he has all these herky-jerky moves and these unique ways that he could score over and around you. But yeah, it was good to see him with confidence into knocking down some pull-up jumpers and making plays that we saw the old Markelle Fultz make. And, you know, that we still have to see the perimeter jumper, the free throw, to make sure the jumper form isn't as weird and bizarre as it was earlier in the year when it looks like the Monstars stole his talent in the middle of the game. But yeah, ultimately, Markelle Fultz has the talent to still be the best player in this class. And, you know, that's saying a lot with guys like Donovan Mitchell breaking out, but there's a reason why, you know, he was the number one pick in the Sixers traded multiple draft picks for him. Markelle Fultz has some special abilities.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the insight on that and definitely the insight into Loyola and the Final Four. So you have Villanova taking down Michigan, which I think a lot of people can foresee, but as we've seen with this, how this tournament's gone, you know, anything's possible. So I wouldn't entirely be surprised if in a few days we're talking about a Loyola Chicago championship, which I'm sure would be pretty crazy in Chicago and where you're living.
Yeah, I don't expect it, but you know what? I've learned not to count out the Ramblers and Sister Jean throughout this whole process, so you never know. They do have a favorable matchup with Michigan if certain things go the right way, but it'd be an uphill battle having to beat a one seed, but it would be a heck of a story.
Yeah, I definitely agree, and it'll be fun to watch, and you know, it's kind of crazy how quickly the college basketball season has gone. It feels like just yesterday it was October, and you know, we were at the USA event and getting ready for the kickoff of college basketball. And here we are with Villanova, Kansas, and then Michigan and Loyola, Chicago, who nobody would have expected. So it's been a fun season that's come to an end quickly. But just wanted to thank you for coming on and providing a lot of good insights into what to be watching over the tournament and how Loyola, Chicago really formed their Final Four run. So appreciate it as always, Scott.
Yeah, thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me on.